Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Ethics Talk. My name is Hope May, and I am joined by Riley Olson.
Hello.
Hi. So we are both connected with the Department of Philosophy and Religion at Central Michigan University. I am a professor of philosophy there, and Riley is a senior philosophy student. And we have been reading Arthur Schopenhauer's 1840 essay on the basis of morality. We highly recommend this text. It is dense. It requires hours of processing and discussion and dialogue. And one of the things that Schopenhauer is doing in this essay is really disagreeing with Immanuel Kant. And so that is basically the sort of big picture of our topic for today, but more specifically, the role of feeling, and in particular, the feeling of respect, and whether or not Kant has any room for feeling, affect, emotion in his ethical theory. So the basis of our discussion is an article by Paul Guyer called Schopenhauer, Kant, and Compassion. A link to the abstract of this article appears on the description of this show on the Blog Talk Radio page. For copyright reasons, we cannot post the PDF of the article to our show page, but hopefully you can access it somehow through JSTOR or interlibrary loan or something. So that's the article that sort of is the basis for this dialogue, and even more specific, not the whole article, but the second part of the article, which is focused on Kant and sympathy. And let me find the direct title of that, Kant, Reason, and Sympathy. So this is like part two of the article. So that's the background of what we're doing today, and we will begin by just, if Riley, could explain, give us a sort of 101 introduction on Schopenhauer's view, his ethical theory as he lays out in this essay on the basis of morality.
Yeah, so Schopenhauer basically thinks that you can have this theoretical insight into just the unity, the underlying unity of reality. And from this, he thinks that you realize that everything is one, and so other people are not separate from yourself. And from this realization necessarily flows compassion. And so his ethics is centered around compassion, as he sees it's necessary and sufficient for moral motivation. So to be motivated to act morally, one has to have compassion.
Okay, and so this feeling of compassion, as you say, arises from a metaphysical insight into the unity of all things. And so I realize that you are not really different from me, this kind of thing, and therefore, yeah, I act with compassion towards you. Is that his view?
Yeah, I think so. And it's kind of realizing that you yourself are not any greater or different from anyone else. So not acting as preferentially for yourself because you realize that you're not different or separate.
Do you think that his claim that if I realize the underlying unity of all things, that necessarily leads to compassion, is true. That is, do you think that this metaphysical insight automatically leads me to this feeling of compassion? Do you agree with that?
I don't think that that's true. I don't think that it's as necessary or as automatic as he makes it seem. It just doesn't, I don't know, just recognizing that everything is the same as you, well, what if that means you, like, you have to have compassion for yourself first. And I don't buy it. And also, it seems like he thinks that you can't really have compassion without having some sort of insight like this. And I don't know if that's necessarily true either.
Interesting. So what you said before was, you said, because I think it helps, at least for me, I make a distinction amongst this insight, number one. Number two, the feeling of compassion. And number three, the action of, like, caring, like taking care of someone else or helping someone else. Do you?
Right.
Okay. I just want to make sure we're on the same page. So what you said before was, first you have to have compassion for yourself. That's really cool, and that deserves a whole show in and of itself. But
definitely.
Yeah, do you mean, like, before I actually help someone or act on my compassion, I have to have compassion for myself? Or were you talking about before I feel compassion for someone else, I have to have compassion for myself?
I was thinking more like the second sense, because it's how Schopenhauer's thinking is that compassion flows from that insight into the unity of yourself with everyone and everything else. That you would then extend compassion to all of that. Like, you would have to have compassion first, I think. From Schopenhauer's view, it's like compassion, like, comes to be from this insight, but I don't see how that happens, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it would have to be there in the first place.
But clearly, there are people, I mean, and they're deemed to have a personality disorder called codependency when they're not even thinking of themselves, and they're just selflessly helping other people without regard, allegedly, to themselves. So in such cases, it seems like you can have compassion for other people and not have compassion for yourself.
Yeah, I think that's... No? Yeah, that seems true, definitely.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, because... Go ahead.
I would say then that, like, especially since you could have compassion for others without having compassion for yourself, too, I think that, and it seems that Schopenhauer thinks that it's coming from a compassion for yourself towards others, or just some sort of positive regard for yourself to then regard others and bring them up to that level, say. But, you know, there's these disconnects between compassion for yourself and compassion for others that we see. And so if that's flowing from the insight that everything is one, that just, I don't think that works.
Right. Cool. So to sum up, compassion, you said, for Schopenhauer, is necessary and sufficient for moral motivation. You have it, and once you have it, you're going to act in a morally correct way. And there are no moral actions that are not motivated by compassion. And so however you think of the feeling, and maybe it's like this warm and loving feeling for other people, I don't know. But yeah, Schopenhauer seems to definitely be focused on this, like, warmth and this, full feeling inside. And he takes Kant to task for allegedly not giving any role whatsoever to this, quote, warm feeling for others or for oneself. And so do you want to say anything more about that before we move on to Kant?
No. I thought about Schopenhauer. What do you think about Kant?
And to be fair to Schopenhauer, as you and I discussed when we were preparing this show, Schopenhauer's interpretation of Kant is not the, like, he's not the only one who interprets Kant this way.
Right.
So it's not just Schopenhauer here. So if Schopenhauer is wrong, many other people are wrong in their interpretation of Kant. So let's get into that sort of Schopenhauer received view of Kant. Do you think you can sum that up?
The Schopenhauer's view of Kant?
Yeah.
So, yeah, he just thinks that in Kant there's no role for compassion at all. And then with Geyer's article, Kant seems to then say that compassion could be necessary for moral motivation, but not sufficient the way Schopenhauer wants it to be. But it could still, like, it does still play a role. Not, Schopenhauer's not right in saying that there's no role at all for it.
Okay. So that's getting into the critique of Schopenhauer. So we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. But at the very least, there's no role. According to Schopenhauer, compassion plays no role whatsoever in moral action for Kant.
Right.
And so, correct me, the received view of Kant that I'm familiar with, that it's more like it's all this faculty of reason, and there's this distinction made between feeling and reason, okay? And Kant is like, feeling plays no role whatsoever, and reason plays the only role. And you have to will an action that proceeds from principles or maxims that have certain logical properties. So it's all about reason and logic and zero about feeling. Is that a simple way of describing Kant's view according to Schopenhauer?
Yeah, that's definitely Schopenhauer's interpretation of Kant, is just purely reason, no feeling at all.
Yeah.
And then that is coming from Geyer saying that Schopenhauer was only reading the groundwork, where Kant is kind of doing like a thought experiment where he opposes two people that are on opposite ends, like at extremes of one who's only motivated by inclinations or feelings, desires, and then the other person is only motivated by reason, as to like get to what is the fundamental principle. And then he concludes, like, morality must be based in reason and not based in inclinations. And then Schopenhauer takes that to be his whole, like, the whole picture. Whereas, so then that interpretation comes that it's only reason, no role for feelings at all.
this view that it's all reason and no feelings whatsoever, Geyer, as you're pointing out in this article that I mentioned, disagrees with this for various reasons. And you're pointing out one of the reasons why Schopenhauer is incorrect is because the Kantian text that he's basing this interpretation on is not the only relevant Kantian text. Schopenhauer is focused on the groundwork, and you're also pointing out that Kant is doing something very specific in these passages that Schopenhauer is just not getting this thought experiment. And also, there's another text called The Metaphysics of Morals, and part two of that is called The Doctrine of Virtue, which really seems to, in this text, give a role to feeling. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
Do you want to add anything to this?
Yes. Sorry. So the role for feeling comes out here, and as far as like this feeling of respect, which comes out for oneself and for the moral law and for others. So that's kind of going right up against what Schopenhauer was saying, that there's no role for anything like sympathy or compassion for Kant. But in the Doctrine of Virtue, he elaborates these aesthetic preconditions to the mind's receptivity to duty. So that's kind of where you could say that compassion or something like compassion is necessary for moral motivation for Kant, because that like ability, that sort of feeling has to be there in order to like think of the idea of duties or to act on them. You have to have some sort of feeling like that.
Cool. If you want to call in and ask a question, our number is 516-387-1449. If you have a comment or question on what we're talking about, please call in 516-387-1449. Right, so the Doctrine of Virtue, this other text that Geyer is pointing us to, well, we'll talk about that in a minute, but before, you mentioned a term that I don't feel like I understand it, and I know it's extremely important to Kantian ethics. So we said, like, the traditional interpretation is it's all reason, no feeling. This is Kant's sort of approach, that morality has everything to do with reason, nothing to do with feeling. And you mentioned this word inclinations before, which is a very important concept to Kant. And is an inclination the same thing as a feeling? Like, can you talk about inclinations a little bit?
Yeah. So inclinations and feelings are not quite the same thing for Kant. So an inclination is something that is, we could compare to the idea of like appetites, passions, desires, emotions. And so those kind of driving forces that, you know, they do present as feelings, like very often, but those are the sorts of things where for Kant, in order to act morally, you have to be able to act against your inclinations for the sake of duty. And then feelings aren't quite the same, because it's something that you do feel, like, so he mentions the feeling of respect, but that feeling isn't an inclination the same way that it's not like a desire for something in some way, it's like a reverence or an awe. So it is a feeling, but it's not an inclination in the same way that other emotions are. It's not a desire.
Is an inclination, can I say an inclination is the same thing as an impulse?
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. Like an impulse or a want that you might not necessarily act on, but it is like an impulse.
I'm getting ahead of myself. But okay, so let's think of an inclination like an impulse. And is Kant's claim here that to behave morally, I have to go against my inclinations? That is, am I always going against my inclinations, or can I have some impulse for the moral law, or, you know, for morally right behavior, whatever that is. So not all impulses necessarily are putting me in the directing me towards the wrong ends. Are there some inclinations / impulses that may align with morally right behavior?
Yeah. So this is kind of an issue that gets interpreted in some different ways, but it seems to be that in order to act morally, you have to be able to act against your inclinations.
Mm.
And so an act in which, like, whatever the moral law calls for is, say, opposite to your inclinations. If you act in agreement with the moral law and against your inclinations, then that is, like, a morally good act. Mm-hmm. And if you act according to the moral law and your inclinations also happen to be doing what that says, like...
Mm-hmm. Like aligned.
You could be acting morally, but that is something within the agent more so. So it's like, which one was the motivating force?
Mm.
So are you doing it because of your inclinations, or are you doing it because of, like, the moral law, basically? And so that's where it comes in. It's if you would do this action, even if your inclinations were not aligned with it, then it's good. So it's not that inclinations are bad necessarily, it's just that in order to have duties, we have to have these inclinations and we have to be able to act against them.
Okay, that helps. Thank you very much for clearing that up. If you have any questions, comments, 516-387-1449. Okay, so we're clear. There's like this, like these impulses, and then there's this moral law thing. And Kant says it's like when we have an external legislator, so whatever, a king or a Congress promulgating laws which force us to behave in a certain way. That's like the external lawgiver, but there's an internal lawgiver. And the law can be known to reason, and to act morally is to understand the dictates of reason and act according, even if your impulses may be opposite to that. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
Now, yeah, so this picture definitely sounds like feelings have no role. But, as you said,
right,
there's this other text, as we both said, the Metaphysics of Morals, the Doctrine of Virtue. And the year of the publication of this, do you recall? I think it's 1797. Is that right?
I do not remember.
Oof. I think it's 1797. It's on. It should be on the show description.
Sounds right.
So I'll bet a crisp $1 bill that it's 1797.
It is 1797.
Yeah, you know, and how I remember that is because, you know, the peace flag is designed in 1897, you see. So in that text, which I must confess I haven't studied at all, like actually I've read about it. I haven't read the text myself. I actually recently obtained it and read all of 4 pages. And in the 4 pages that I read, which Geyer directed me to in the article, indeed, he's talking about at least 4 different, and you used the phrase before, aesthetic preconditions of the mind's receptivity to duty. Wow. He says aesthetic preconditions. I mean, how about affective, right? Or emotional. I think affective preconditions of the mind's receptivity to duty. Yeah,
absolutely.
So this is a whole 4-page section in the Doctrine of Virtue, which is part 2 of the Metaphysics of Morals. And the 4 affective preconditions or aesthetic preconditions I'll just go down the list and we'll talk about them. Number one, Kant calls moral feeling. Number one. Number two is conscience. And these are affective preconditions, so they feel in a certain way. Love of man is three. And number four is reverence or respect. The same thing, using two different English words to describe this fourth affective precondition. So do you want to pick one of these to begin with?
Yeah, we could talk about moral feeling. Okay. I think that kind of will be easier to connect to what we were just talking about with respect for the moral law.
Okay. So what do you get about moral feeling?
So this is like the pleasure or pain that we feel that if we act like in accordance or against the moral law, and also if we see others act in accordance or against it. So it's like, you know, there's kind of this warm feeling if you act in a way that is like in accordance with the moral law, and sort of maybe a feeling of guilt or shame if you act against it, or maybe like if you see someone act against it, there may be some sort of resentment there, or if you see someone act according with it, it might be kind of like, again, another warm feeling. And I think that the way he distinguishes this sort of thing from an inclination would be that it's not toward another end of some sort. Like, it's for the moral law. And the feeling, and it feeling good isn't, like, what draws you to it. That's how you know that it, or not know, I don't know. That was like
yeah, that makes sense.
Sort of stage, I guess.
Yeah, that rings
how you come
through.
In contact with it, how you experience it, yeah.
Yeah, so like this moral feeling is an effect of either like acting in accordance. Let's suppose you do act in accordance with the moral law, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the claim is you're going to feel pleasure if you act in accordance with it. And I would make the claim that we all have this experience that when we see ourselves doing what we know we should do, it feels good. I call it a good, clean feeling, right? So you know, Riley, that I talk about doing ultradian spreads, and these are 90-minute intervals where you turn off the internet and you just read. And I know I should be doing that 4 times a day, and when I do, I feel really good, okay?
Yeah.
And if I don't, I feel bad, but don't we also have the experience, and I know I do, like I once said to someone, why does it feel so good when we do bad? So sometimes
right.
It feels really good when we act wrongly, does it not?
It does.
So what's up with that?
That means we haven't cultivated our moral feeling enough. We haven't cultivated our conscience enough.
Yeah, that sounds very, like Aristotle says something like, we haven't, like, our tastes are all awry, and we haven't tasted what it's really like to act in accordance with the moral law, and we're sort of addicted to this baser pleasure. But anyway, so this is what he means by moral feeling. And if we don't act in a way that we should, we feel that we should or know that we should, we're going to feel pain. And so you said this is not the same thing as inclinations, because an inclination is like an impulse for something. But that's not
right.
Moral feeling. It's like an effect of something. It's an effect of witnessing or beholding
right.
the moral law and acting or not acting, or seeing someone else act or not act in accordance with it.
Right. Because like an inclination would be like a impulse to satisfy some sort of desire, whereas a feeling, like, it's not the feeling that you get, like, that's not towards satisfying some desire necessarily. It's like a different kind of incentive.
No, I'm not totally prepared to develop this line of thought, but you just triggered in me by saying that this bit in Schopenhauer, which I know you and I have talked about maybe like a month ago, where his view of happiness is that it's just satisfaction of desire. Do you remember this bit? And so you're always like, there's no real way to sustain happiness. You're really like always in pain because you're always in the state of want, and
right,
it may be a temporary intermission.
Negative.
Yeah, exactly, that whole bit. So this seems to be
a
departure from this view, because this moral feeling is not something that arises from the satisfaction of a lack. Rather, it's like this feeling that supervenes on or is a crown of witnessing or beholding something in accordance or not with accordance with the law. So it's like supervening on something.
I think that that's a really good way to draw the distinction. Like Schopenhauer's idea of happiness is like the ending, like endings of suffering, basically, or intermissions. I think that can be seen as like understanding inclination working in that way. And then this moral feeling is kind of like an end in itself. Self almost, or a positive happiness.
Right. So Schopenhauer's psychological inventory is impoverished. He doesn't recognize this moral feeling piece of furniture, if you will. And he's just positing inclinations and the satisfaction thereof, and they never can be totally satisfied. Cool. But like, thank you for. That was like an aha moment just there. Okay, so that's moral feeling. And again, if you have any comments, insights, aha moments yourself to share, 516-387-1449. So we mentioned four affective preconditions of the mind's receptivity to duty. We just talked about the first one, moral feeling, which is like this supervening affect when something comes into relation with the moral law, something like this.
Yeah.
Okay, you wanna go to another one? You can pick. There's three more that we have: conscience, love of man, and reverence are the other three affective preconditions. Where would you like to go? We have entered the forest of aesthetic preconditions.
I think that we can just go down the list. I guess since we started with the first one, we can do conscience next.
All right. So conscience, what would you like to say about conscience?
Yeah, so we have a kind of, it's like the predisposition basically, or disposition, I guess, to ask whether actions are in line with the moral law, or it's kind of like to holding duty in your attention. So I guess just like holding moral feeling at the forefront of your attention, so that, you know, if you have strong conscience, like acting all of your actions, like you'll be considering them morally rather than just like acting without thinking, say.
So it's this like moment when the person asks, you know, what is my duty? And then like holding that duty and that action that conforms with that duty in one's mind.
Yeah. It's Jiminy Cricket.
Okay, can you explain that to me?
Like the cricket from Pinocchio.
Yeah, I haven't seen Pinocchio in a long time,
kind of like,
so I need a refresher on this one.
Oh, you know, he's always just like asking, like, oh, is this right? Like, oh, should you really do this? Like, is this the right thing? Like, you need to think this way. Like, you have to be thinking about these things when you're I don't know, just kind of like a little cricket on your shoulder, almost a little voice, just kind of reminding you, like, hey, should we do this? Like, is this really the thing we should be doing? Or, hey, I know I really want that thing, but should I really do that? Just kind of to question and to think about whether things are in line with the moral law.
So interesting, because how we set up this list of four things, we said it's like affective preconditions of the mind's receptivity to duty. And what you're describing is this like holding man's duty like in front of attention, which doesn't really seem to be affective. It's more like, I mean, I don't think of like feeling or affect when I think holding something in my mind's eye. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that you have to have the ability to do that,
mm-hmm.
To then like do something with your moral feelings or to sorry, I had like a thought on this. It's kind of it's escaping from me. I keep trying to grab it. It's like water.
So like, yeah, I don't disagree that you have to have this ability. Like this ability is crucial to like recognize like what is my duty, to ask the question and then to hold it there. I agree that it's necessary. I'm just questioning whether that is the same thing as that a feeling? So we talked about moral feeling, it's pleasure and pain. I don't really see pleasure and pain coming into this act of the will, or whatever you want to call it.
The conscience and like holding it in front of you, that is a way of like representing it to yourself. So like your conscience is like this faculty that is like kind of holding this representation there. And so it's not like pleasure, pain, feeling, that sort of way, but it is still like an aesthetic precondition because you're having this, it's like a act of like imagination almost, like you're holding this image in your mind's eye that is kind of like seeing it in a way. And so feeling is kind of not, it's difficult to explain it that way, but it is in this sort of like internal like effect on you in a way, like an effect on your capacity, like you're having this representation in front of you, and that's like affecting you that way, I guess, like a feeling or something.
I'm almost tempted to make a claim that this moral feeling, okay, the pleasure or pain almost like paves the way for conscience. Because if I'm feeling pleasure in imagining myself acting in accordance with the law, right, doesn't that prime me to act in accordance with the law? And then don't I then need to exercise conscience to hold it there? So I want to make the claim that there's some kind of like interaction here and maybe a causal story that moral feeling is going to come first. I don't know. But I did want to take the opportunity to connect this idea of conscience with something that William James talks about, and these bits are from the Talks to Teachers. It's published in 1899. William James makes claims like moral activity is the result of a, quote, resolute effort of voluntary attention to drag the right name into the field, that is, the field of consciousness, so that it can exert its motor effects. And it's like holding this thing in your mind's eye for long enough for your body, for it to like go to work on your body. I love this idea. And these ideas have motor effects, and ambulatory, that is your arms and legs, will move or not move pursuant to specific ideas. So the task is to have the idea, that is the moral law, and then hold it there for a sufficient amount of time so that your body will act accordingly. So we may come back to that with a clip, but I would like to get through the list first, unless you have a strong objection and you want to play the clip that we've talked about.
No, I think that's fine. I was just going to say that I think what William James is saying is exactly what Kant means with conscience.
Mm-hmm. So this kind of like muscle and strength to hold something in one's attention, that's conscience. So you need all of this inner architecture, right, to even to act in accordance with the moral law. It's not like a simple thing. There's all this other like psychological ability and emotional ability at play. Okay, so the next one on the list is, so we've talked about moral feeling, just rehearsing. It's the pleasure and pain that you feel when acting in accordance or against the moral law. Number two, we talked about conscience, which is just like holding the duty, the law before you. Love of man. And this seems to be the most similar to the Schopenhauer idea of compassion. But we're going to say that it's not. So, Riley, talk about the love of man a little bit.
Yeah, it's kind of like a love or respect for others, like in virtue of them being humans, of respect for their personhood, and and like kind of feeling to like help them and want, and like I think that this plays into the idea of just respect and reverence for like the ability of others to follow the moral law too, and just or just the ability to self-govern, and so it's like wanting to support others in that endeavor.
So it sounds kind of like recognition of the dignity of others, because they can also act in accordance with this moral law that's within this inner legislator, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and interestingly, and this is from the Doctrine of Virtue, it would be section 401. you and I talked about this passage before. He says, you know, when you have the love of man, you even have this toward the misanthrope, he says, misanthropist, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that, but the misanthropy. So if there's someone who hates man, you have to love him, and it's your duty to love him. But he says, you cannot love him, but we can still render good to him. And that's what he means. And he makes a distinction in this section about this like subjective feeling of love versus this respect that you're talking about, and just helping other people see the inner law within themselves.
Right.
So you
it's
don't
like
necessarily
not,
have a warm feeling towards people.
It's not even like a love for others necessarily, but it's just like a love for humanity.
And this is is this the same thing as Schopenhauer's compassion? I mean, do you see a connection disconnect here?
I don't really think so. Like it's for Kant, the sort of love, this feeling that's not like the end, I guess. Whereas for Schopenhauer, like that's just it, that's morality, there you go. But for Kant, it's just this precondition that you have to be able to to do these sorts of things, but that alone isn't enough. That's not how you can act morally. You have to have, there's even like a quote from Geyer on page 425 where he says, to be sufficient for human virtue, compassion has to be accompanied by conscience. So it's like you have to have conscience with this love too. You can't just have that and act morally, you know.
And wasn't there, like in Schopenhauer, these passages where he's really railing on Kant for just being like really cold and not in line with our Christian conception of charity? Like, do you remember these sentences? Like, there's no sympathy, there's no warm feeling. Does that ring any bells? Like, this is a slavish morality. I remember this passage. It's a slavish morality because...
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Because it sounds like, you know, part of the helping others that Kant seems to be advocating is so that you can kind of practice your own potential and become more, like... benevolent, where it turns into kind of an egoism in your acts of compassion, because it seems that you're just, you know, using people as a means to your end of becoming more benevolent.
This is another thing that Kant says in the Doctrine of Virtue, that he does explicitly say that you need to, I'm just reading, you need to do good to your fellow man, and this will give rise to love of man in you. So
yeah.
It sounds like I need to do good to others because that will help me love myself more and therefore act in accordance more with the moral law or something like this, which Schopenhauer says sounds like it's just, that's not very nice. And that's not in keeping with sympathy and this kind of thing. Anything else you want to say about the difference between... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I almost wonder with that too, because with Kant, if it's this love of something in you that is also in these people and others, like, is that kind of getting to something similar with Schopenhauer? I don't know, that was just a little side thought. I don't have much else to say about it, but
yeah, because that goes back to this claim, like there's this unity and we recognize that, and that causes this feeling of compassion. Going back to this causal story amongst these four different aesthetic preconditions or affective preconditions, I made the claim that moral feeling is going to somehow pave the way for conscience. And my question is like, okay, since we're talking about Schopenhauer, because Schopenhauer has this causal story about you have this metaphysical insight and that causes the compassion and then that causes the action. So it's insight, feeling, action, and an action that must, you know, be compassionate and altruistic and so forth. So do you see like any kind of causal story here where like, where does the love of man come in here? And maybe there is no causal story. I just raise it as a question because Schopenhauer definitely seems to think that there is a causal story. Is there anything that precedes?
All of these things, come out of like one feeling of reverence or respect for autonomy, the like just the simple ability to self-govern, and that gives rise to the respect for the moral law that one would adopt to govern themselves through conscience, the love of man, the reverence or respect for your own being. Like those seem to come from, for Kant, from this overall respect for self-governance, I guess.
So I would tweak that a bit, at least in the doctrine of virtue. So I would say it's not, I agree that all of these things are coming from one insight or one consciousness. And he says it's consciousness not of my autonomy, that actually my reverence for myself follows something else, which is the reverence for the law. So, like, I first have reverence for the law, and then I have reverence for myself because the law is in myself. And then, but yeah, there is this sentence that these aesthetic preconditions, moral feeling, conscience, love of man, reverence, they follow from consciousness of a moral law. So that is like Schopenhauer, right? There are these consequent feelings, psychological effects of a recognition of something, of some metaphysical insight. It's the moral law that's the big daddy, I think, for Kant. Yeah, so they're not as
Also,
far apart
not
as.
the.
Yeah.
Um,
Say it
I think
again?
also for Kant, just sorry.
Not at all. Anytime.
I think that these like aesthetic preconditions, whatever, I think that they are things that are already there before the recognition of the law, almost so the capacity for compassion, say, that is already there, and you can cultivate it, you can guide it with reason, you can affect it. But then for Schopenhauer, it is no, it's not there. You have the insight, and then it arises. It comes out of it. Instead of just
Yeah.
one difference between them there.
And I would say for Kant, it's already there because the moral law is like part of, like, it's in the noumenal whatever. And it's having this effect on our phenomenal reality. And that expresses itself, that reality of the noumenal law, moral law, if that makes any sense, because I'm not sure I'm making sense now. But there's this thing that exists, and to some extent we're connected with it, and the effect of being connected with it are these aesthetic preconditions. So yeah, they're already there, like you said, but they're there because the moral law is already there. And it's not
And
like the
some
moral law is
thought.
totally transparent, okay? It's not totally transparent to myself. So it's more like there's these little glimmers, these little feelings that I have, and I'm moved in certain ways. And yeah, my attention needs to like focus on that and cultivate those things so that the moral law becomes more and more present in my inner resources, right, and in my action. So, I mean, as you know, because we've been talking about these ideas for some time now, and I'll just say it, I just can't help, and that's because Aristotle says, like, all learning begins with what you already know, so you can't help but connect new things with things that are already there in your consciousness. That is how we learn. But I can't help but connect Kant's approach to Plato's. And as I've said, like, this idea of the good is in us, but it's not, we're not like totally aware of it. And it's a process of excavation and inner labor, and not just with regards to intellect, but also passions and what we've been calling inclinations and impulses, that this thing is going to become like more and more clear to us. And I think that the like these things, like you're saying, these a set of preconditions we have to cultivate them so that we can hold the law and act according to it more readily and stuff.
Yeah. absolutely, because like what you brought up with like phenomenal and noumenal, like these like a set of preconditions, these are like phenomenal experiences that we have, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the like moral law itself is something noumenal,
mm-hmm.
I believe. And so like the only things that we can know are phenomena, like in Kant's view, like the only things that we can like know. And so this is the only way we would have, like you're saying, like any access to it, I guess. And this is like, this is the way we can experience the moral law.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like you're saying, it's something that you have to cultivate and to make it clearer or weave it together.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, so I just want to like highlight this duty to cultivate that is in Kant. this duty to cultivate these like moral feeling, mm-hmm. conscience, love of man, and reverence. This is in the doctrine of virtue. And so Schopenhauer, because we have like 3 minutes left, we began the show by saying like Schopenhauer's view is that feeling plays no role whatsoever. And what we're saying now, thanks to Geyer pointing us to this text, the Metaphysics of Morals, Doctrine of Virtue, yeah, feelings play a role, and you have a duty to cultivate these specific feelings because they are necessary to the, quote, mind's receptivity to duty. I love that phrase, by the way, the mind, like,
yeah.
That's just, I need to, you know, meditate on that for a while.
I know what you mean.
So I don't think we really, like, we have, like, 2 minutes left, but reverence and respect, which requires more than 2 minutes, but Riley, how about, you know, giving us a, like, riffing on this for, like, a minute, if you can.
Oh, man. Well, I think that would be, like, one, so it's reverence and respect for one's own being, which follows from reverence for the law. So, like, because you respect the law, you respect the ability to act according to the law.
Mm.
So you respect the capacity for autonomy in yourself, I guess. You respect your receptivity to duty. And so in that, you act according to it and cultivate this ability within yourself to act according to the law because you respect the law. So you respect yourself because you can follow it.
And does this respect for the law, like, it seems to sound like, oh my God, we have like 90 seconds left. But okay, here's our final question that we'll end with. And we didn't get to play our clip, so maybe we'll continue this next time. This respect for the law, or this reverence respect, does that, like, how does that connect to moral feeling? Because we said moral feeling is like the pleasure the pleasure that we feel when acting in accordance with the law. My question is, how does that pleasure connect to the feeling of respect for the law? I don't know. I just need to think about it.
I guess it's like, if you think about, like, if you say someone that you, like, really respect as, like, a role model or something, and who you see as, like, a virtuous person, and, like, if you see someone, like, bad-mouthing them, say, or, like, insulting them to their face, like, you feel bad, like, it makes you angry, like, they're not respecting that person that you respect and that you know deserves respect. Yes, I don't know.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Well, with that, we'll let that be the last word. So you have been listening to Ethics Talk. We have been discussing Kant and Schopenhauer on moral motivation. Stay tuned for our next show. And stay safe and stay sane. Goodbye.
Bye.